Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode 132 of I Wish You Were Dead, a podcast about things that used to be alive. My name is Mike, that is Gavin, and we are going old school today, just the two of us. How you doing, Gavin?
I'm doing good. As Mike and I were talking about right before we got started, I watched the Weird Al movie over the weekend. 10 out of 10. That's one of the best movies I've seen in a long time. It is right up my alley. If you watch that movie, you will understand my sense of humor perfectly. I would also recommend having a drink or two, if you're of age beforehand.
And we, it was funny because, it was just one of the few weekends where I also watched a movie. I went to the movie theater and I saw Lisa Frankenstein with somebody, which feels like it's a movie that's trying to be so bad that it's good, but is actually just like a really like funny and charming and endearing and also horrifying movie. Like also very recommended. It was great stuff.
Yeah, so it's a fun movie-filled weekend. Mike Fia and I also had a fun off week, I guess. You know, the podcast comes out every other week.
Get some context to that.
Yeah, so we normally record, you know, every other week, just the same as the podcast comes out every other week. But Mike Fia and I joined another podcast. We will not talk about it further because it's not going to come out on their end for at least another, like, 3 months.
It's kind of weird for us to even tease this. We did this thing. It was awesome. The people we did it with were cool, but like, you guys aren't going to hear it for a while.
Yeah, for sure. And honestly, I'm probably going to forget about it until it shows up in my own podcast feed. For me to then talk about the next time we record. but in the meantime, I am going to try to actually, for real this time, he said for like the eighth time, do some social media shenanigans, even though I'm really bad at it. But that is on my to-do list. So hopefully, if you follow us on the social media, you'll see this episode posted.
And if you are somebody that wants to be a very unpaid social media manager, reach out to us so that way Gavin doesn't have to do this on his own.
Yeah, and you know, I hate the whole paid in exposure thing.
Right. But also, we make $0 from this.
Yes, we make literal $0.
I've said this before. We've lost money on this podcast, yes. And I'm okay with that.
We are not currently losing money, but we, on net, are negative for the podcast.
Which, to be clear, we're fine with. We're not doing this to make money.
Yeah.
But if you want to be a social media person, so that way Gavin doesn't have to keep trying to convince himself he's going to get on this.
Right, that's one of the things with having ADHD as well, is like, yeah, you keep setting deadlines for yourself, and then you forget them, and then you just beat yourself up about it, and that just makes you less likely to do the thing in the future. So, it's the ADHD spiral. Anywho.
Well, let's put Gavin out of his misery. All right, what do we do? Fia's not here. What happens next? Is it housekeeping?
Yeah, so some housekeeping, and then we can get into today in history, which I figured, I realized while we were recording with that other unnamed podcast, we've actually very rarely actually mentioned that Mike is a high school history teacher, and that's why we do a today in history.
Have we not mentioned that?
Not it much less often than we should.
Okay. I mean, like, I'm happy that people have no idea who I am, but yeah, okay.
Right, but for the uninitiated... This paleontology podcast opens with a today in human history, that could probably use some extra context.
mm-hmm. That's fair.
Anywho, before we get to today in history, do not forget to rate the show on whatever podcast platform you listen to us on, and to follow us on our various social medias, Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, etc., to be able to give us feedback about the show and suggest any future topics you'd like to hear on the show, if you'd like to be a guest in the future. Speaking of which, we're probably going to have a guest for next episode I'm pretty excited about. If you'd like to be a guest in other future episodes, though, there is a Google form down in the show notes, and you can fill out to sort of quote-unquote apply to be a guest. And as for next episode, ideally, next week is my university spring break, so that frees up a lot of my colleagues for, you know, an hour to record a podcast. So hopefully we're going to be talking with one of my colleagues in the biology department about ants. Ants are super cool and terrifying. One of the coolest, you know, groups of animals around today. We're going to be talking about them and what makes them so neat. So yeah, very excited for that. And we don't have a swamp corner because, like I said, Fia's doing grad school stuff. You know, she's off, you know, learning and
yeah, she's fine. She's just busy.
Yeah. So we'll move on to today in history. What happened? Whatever day this is.
So it's gonna be March 6th, I believe. The one I was gonna say cool thing, but it's not even a cool thing. Like, it's a cool thing, but it's not cool. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
The Alamo ended today in 1836. That is, you know, part of the, or one of the, you know, first moments of the Texas Revolution, where Texas winds up seceding from Mexico and becomes its own country for a little while. What a lot of people don't seem to remember about the Alamo, you always hear, you know, remember the Alamo.
Sure.
Is that Texas lost that battle. The Mexicans won. All right, and it was all, you know, a number of people, including Jim Bowie and Davy Crockett, were killed in that battle. And Davy Crockett, he's one of the kind of American folk heroes that was a real person. Yeah. But it is hard to separate fact from fiction with him a little bit. He's become a little bit larger than life, but even the parts of his life that we can verify, dude still lived kind of an amazing life.
Hmm.
So go check him out if you ever get the chance. Honorable mention or dishonorable mention in 1857, the Dred Scott decision came down. Yeah, that's the last time. If you don't know what the Dred Scott decision is, look that up, because like that's a rough one.
And or pay more attention in your history classes.
Your U.S. history teacher 100% covered that in class.
Yes.
But, you know, not everybody listens. So, yeah, that was a rough one. But, yeah, the Alamo, today in 1836, you know, Texas, you got there eventually. And then, you know, became Texas.
And then you threatened to secede basically every year since, so...
Well, I mean, there was
And then the one time they did.
All right, Gavin, what are we doing today?
Yeah, today we are talking about whales. And, oh boy, this is a whale of an episode. Brunts.
Boo! Boo!
For real, though, this was one of the longest, like, outlines I've had for an episode. So, strap in, folks. I say, as it's almost 9 o'clock.
I want to make a That's What She Said joke somewhere in there, but I'm not exactly sure like how it would fit.
Yeah, keep thinking
that right there. Actually, That's What She Said.
Oh, jeez. Okay, well,
I wasn't even trying to do that.
You're so talented. So whales. Whales are some of the coolest, in my opinion, most interesting groups of animals in all of Earth's history, and honestly, we're all just kind of really lucky to live at the same time as them. Because they are just so, number one, huge. That's like what the number one thing they're known for. But just so unique and weird compared to all the other mammals that just being around, you think of, you know, all these weird fossil groups in the fossil record, and you're like, man, it'd be cool to live at the same time as them. This is the first group, maybe other than elephants, that we've talked about on the show, where I've been like, just living on the same planet at the same time as these guys is just really cool.
So, the way you phrase it like that makes it sound like whales have some sort of expiration date, or they are going...
Well, we did get real close, and we will talk about that.
Okay, let's hit it.
So, whales, or more scientifically, the order Cetacea, are the most diverse group of fully aquatic mammals, and it's kind of not even close. So pinnipeds, which are your seals and sea lions and stuff, they have about 35 species. Sirenians have like 4. Those are your manatees and dugongs. Otters, which aren't fully aquatic, but yeah, more or less. They only have like 13 species. There are around 90.
Wait, hold on. What do you mean otters aren't fully aquatic?
I mean, they can come on land.
Oh, so if something is fully aquatic, like, it basically can only exist in the water.
Yeah, there's really only two, like, fully aquatic groups of mammals. It's just the whales and the sirenians. Whereas, like, seals and sea lions and stuff, like, for sure can come on land. I think they even give birth on land, I'm pretty sure. Otters, I'm, like, 99% sure they give birth on land.
But those things feel more like amphibious to like, and I know we've talked about issues with that term before, but
yeah,
just like that idea of like, yeah, they're kind of cool either place.
Yeah. But whales, there are about 90 species, depending on how you lump or split them, but ballpark around 90. And like I said, they are most famous for being really, really big. They range from the smallest being 4.5 to 5 feet long, about 100 pounds. It's a very critically endangered species called the vaquita, which is native to the northern Gulf of California on the west coast of Mexico. All the way up to the, not critically, but just endangered, blue whale, being about 100 feet long at the top end and about 200 tons.
Damn.
And to be clear, the next largest, like, thing that's not a whale is the African elephant, which, like, tops out at about 10 tons. That's, like, a gigantic male elephant is like, 10 tons. So.
So this is what we're dealing with.
It's not close. And, in fact, blue whales are the largest animal ever that we know of. There was a contender as a fossil whale that I actually didn't end up putting into this because it was published last year. At the time, it was a whale that, based on the bones, was just, like, real thick.
How many seas?
Oh, many seas.
Okay.
Where it wasn't as long as a blue whale, but just because it was just real round, could have got pretty close to, in terms of weight. In the last, like, that was just published last year. In the last couple of months, there's been some other studies that say it probably wasn't quite as large as that first study claimed. But anyway, blue whale, probably the largest animal to ever exist. As most people know, the other thing that whales are most famous for is that they are fully aquatic. Basically, like I said, just them and the Sirenians, the manatees and their relatives, that are fully aquatic or marine mammals. There are other things throughout history, like ichthyosaurs and mosasaurs and stuff, that are reptiles. But for mammals, it's kind of just these two. And they live all across all the oceans and even in many rivers across the world. A little hometown thing. There's even some whales that live in the very northern parts of the St. Lawrence River. That's the river that the Great Lakes drain into to go out into the ocean. So belugas live in the very northern parts of the river and in the past have gotten a bit more south than they do today. But not really as far south as New York that I'm aware of. Yeah, so whales today are sort of split into two main groups. There's the Mysticeti, or the baleen whales. These are the big whales, pretty much. They're the ones that they don't have teeth. Instead, they have this hair-like structure called baleen that they use to filter water out of their food, which is mostly krill and other small invertebrates. These are the big ones, like blue whales, humpbacks, gray whales, right whales, stuff like that.
So this is where they, like, just take a big gulp full of water and then, like, push out all the water, and everything that's left stuck in their teeth is theoretically food.
Oh yeah, 100%. Okay, just it's the whale from Finding Nemo.
Right, that was in my head. That's what I was thinking.
Yeah, the other group are called the Odontoceti, or the toothed whales. These are things like dolphins, porpoises, belugas, narwhals, orcas, and sperm whales. And so, sperm whales are still enormous. They're like about 50 feet long or so. And they are the biggest non-filter feeder in the world. They mostly dive down really deep and eat things like squid. They're really neat. They also are just very bizarre looking. Their head looks like a box.
Why are they called sperm whales?
So we'll talk about it a little bit. Toothed whales have an organ in their head, which is why, especially like a beluga, they have that big bubble on the front of their head.
Right.
That's called a melon, and sperm whales specifically have an organ inside that full of, they mostly in biology be called hair cells, but they look like sperm.
Okay. And that, and they just went with that?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well done, boys. Well done.
Yeah. so yeah, so those are the two main groups of whales that are around today. The ones with teeth and the ones without teeth. That's the main distinction. We'll talk a little bit more about the other differences here in a little bit. But whales have many super crazy adaptations for being very divergent for mammals. like I said, there's only the two groups that live in the water full time, and they're not remotely closely related to each other. So let's talk about some of the weird traits that whales have that other things don't. So in this, you know, next sort of list, there are some differences between the toothed whales and the baleen whales, but in general, these apply to both unless I say that they don't. So first, fins, the things you need to swim around. Whales have flippers instead of arms. They have no external hind limbs, although they do still have a pelvis that's just kind of free-floating inside their body cavity. It's not even connected to their spine anymore. Yeah, it's just like two pieces of bone that are just kind of sit in the body.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Their arm bones are relatively short and very wide, because for a flipper, you don't need flexibility. So they don't have, like, an elbow joint or a wrist joint, really. So they're really short and really wide to be able to withstand a lot of force. Their wrist bones are basically just a few rows of, like, little pebble-like bones. They're very nondescript, just like little cobble stones, basically. And then their phalanges are each relatively short and thick, but there are many, many more of them than we have. So in all of your fingers except for your thumb, you have three bones in each finger, you know, past your knuckle. Depending on the finger, I guess, they can have, you know, many, many, many more.
We're talking six more? Or are we talking 20 more?
I thought I had this in my notes, but I guess not. I think it was like 10 to 15.
Okay.
Mostly on the ring and the middle finger.
Is it the same structure where it's kind of like five fingers per fin, I guess?
More or less. The thumb equivalent is very small, and I think even in the baleen whales, that digit is just completely gone.
Okay.
And then the middle two, our middle and ring finger, are longer and have lots of bones in them. And then I think the pinky also is kind of reduced a bit in the toothed whales. The pinky and thumb, I think, are both pretty small in toothed whales. But they're not, like, separate digits. They're all enclosed within the flipper.
Okay.
The dorsal fin is made up of lots of tendons and cartilage to be able to stay pretty stiff and to help with stability in the water, just like fish or sharks. Although there are some species, like belugas, that don't have a dorsal fin at all. That's probably an adaptation for, particularly with, like, the very Arctic species that need to be able to find ice holes and fit up through them to breathe, or to be able to swim very close to, like, the underside of, an ice flow or something. Their tail fins, or flukes, as they're technically called, are also made up of those same tendons and cartilage and stuff, which is why they don't show up in skeletons that you see, like, mounted in museums. You'll just see the spine, and then it just kind of ends. unlike pretty much everything else in the ocean, their tail fin is positioned horizontally. If you think of, like, a shark or other fish, it's verticals, and they swim sort of side to side, back and forth, whereas whales, they swim up and down. And that's just due to the different ways that mammalian spines have developed, evolved over time. You probably notice in yourself, it is easier to touch your toes bending forward than it is to the side. So mammalian spines are just better at bending that way instead of side to side like a lot of reptiles for, you know, a variety of reasons. But like I said, this is a long episode. We don't have time to get into exactly why that is. Moving on from the fins and stuff, organs. Mostly fat. Whales have a lot of fat, which unfortunately is why many of them were endangered. Mostly this helps with buoyancy and helps insulate them from the cold water around them. Even the ones like bottlenose dolphins and stuff that live in warm water. Water is just much better at taking your internal heat away than air is. So having that layer of insulation just helps you conserve energy when you're in the water.
That makes sense.
Yeah. It also helps streamline their bodies to be more efficient at moving through the water. The blowhole. That's famously how they breathe.
That writes itself.
It sure does. It's famously how they breathe. It's a big hole at the top of their head. That is their nose, functionally. Other aquatic mammals don't have anything like this. Manatees, for example, still have their nose on the end of their snout. They just have a very flexible snout that they can sort of flip up to, you know, breach the water surface when they breathe. Other things, like I said, seals and sea lions, they just have a pretty typical, very dog-like nose. Whales are bizarre because their nares, the technical term for like nostrils, basically just move up the skull so they're situated at the top for easy access to air, since they're still mammals and still, you know, need to breathe air. However, it's not like a new hole just like opened at the top of the skull. So like, we'll talk about this when we talk about their evolution, but imagine a dog-like head.
Right.
And not one of the weird ones like a pug or a bulldog or something, just like a German Shepherd or like a lab or something.
Yep.
Now imagine the nose of that dog just like slides up between the eyes and goes to the top of its head.
That's wild.
With none of the rest of the snout moving.
Why? Why?
Mostly to be able to, you know, breathe without disrupting, you know, your swimming, basically. If it was at the front, you'd have to sort of lean your neck up, and whales have very inflexible necks. So they needed some way to breathe while still maintaining, you know, their swimming speed.
Evolution is wild.
Yeah. Their skulls are so bizarre looking. They have a very long maxilla, which is the bone that most of your upper teeth are on. A super long premaxilla, which is the bone that sort of like your front teeth or incisors are on. So, and then a relatively small nasal bone, which is the actual bone surrounding the nostril. So they just pushed up, like, so the premaxilla basically just pushed the nose all the way up the skull. And in fact, if you look at a baleen whale, they basically just have a big gap in the middle of their skull, just a big like line of empty space in the middle of their skull. Whereas toothed whales sort of filled that in. Their premaxillae touch each other in the middle of their skull, and they just have like a big hole at the top of their skull. Yeah. So it's like a fully enclosed, whereas the baleen whales have like a, you can see where the nose used to be all the way. Also to be weird, toothed whales only have one nostril, while baleen whales have the normal two.
Only have one nostril? Okay. Yep. All right. Is there a story here?
Not particularly, although I did Google it. So apparently it is the left nostril. The right nostril, like, is there. It just doesn't open. Otherwise, it's fully developed. There is, like, a sinus cavity that goes to the right nostril. It just doesn't open. Sure. Bones. Their bones are real weird, with some being super dense, which helps them sort of stay down in the water, especially with all that fat, which is, you know, buoyant. Others are very light or even replaced with cartilage and fat. That helps them sort of regulate where their center of gravity is, which is really important when you're in the water. And these bones, especially in the skull, are really uniquely structured to help with sound transmission. We'll talk quite a bit about sound because it's really important to them, but it also works really differently in water than it does in air. Speaking of that, that's our next little section here. Whales are generally really noisy animals, generally because they're also pretty social. There's a handful of the big ones that are relatively solitary, like blue whales don't really hang out all together all that much. But the smaller ones, like dolphins especially, or orcas, they hang out together a lot. And being able to talk to each other helps with that.
When you say they're loud, do you mean that they are frequently making noise, or that the noise that they make is incredibly loud?
Both.
Okay.
So they just like chitter constantly, especially the toothed whales, because Famously, whales echolocate, but only some of them. It's only the toothed whales that can do that. Blue whales and humpbacks, they don't echolocate.
Huh.
They do make a lot of noise because they sing to each other. We'll talk about that in just a second. But toothed whales, as I mentioned before, have that organ on the head that makes their head look kind of bulbous called a melon. And basically, it's just this big lump of fat and some other specialized tissues that basically they emit the sound out through that, and then they have like sort of an empty cavity on the inside of their lower jaw that's filled with a jelly-like material that helps them receive the sound. So they echolocate right out through the melon and then hear it back through their lower jaw. And
okay.
Yeah, the jaw carries the sound up to the ears. If you've been to the dentist, whenever they're like doing stuff in your lower jaw, you can like feel it in your ears. Similar kind of deal.
I assume that if a human was in the water at this point, we would be able to hear some of what was going on.
For the most part, yeah. The echolocation, some of them, especially some of the bigger ones, like orcas, I think will just kind of scream at their prey, and that will disorient the fish and seals and things.
Okay.
But for the smaller ones, I don't think they use that all that much as like a hunting strategy or anything. However, baleen whales, like I said, don't echolocate, but they do sing. Famously, things like humpback whales sing a lot and have very intricate songs. And these are extraordinarily loud. For example, a blue whale, you can't record right next to it, because even if you could get it to sing when there's a boat right next to it, you know, it would destroy whatever microphone is nearby.
Really?
When it comes to, like, the raw decibels that it's giving off, it's comparable to a rocket launch.
Wow. Okay. Yeah.
And typically, for these big whales, it's infrasound, which is basically the catch-all term for sound that is too low of a frequency for humans to hear with just our raw ears. And that helps it travel much farther. And you can, whales can hear each other from hundreds and hundreds of miles apart. And so it's this, you know, loudness and the low frequency that helps it travel so far. And some, like humpbacks in particular, have super, super complicated songs that the males of a given population share. So like the North Atlantic population have one song that kind of changes a little bit from year to year. The South Atlantic ones have a different song. And they also kind of steal portions of their songs from neighboring populations. You know,
really,
kind of like how culture works. We'll talk
about
that in a bit.
This is nuts. Okay.
And also, just a general thing here, because of how much whales in general, you know, the small ones and the big ones, rely on sound for both hunting and just talking to each other, noise pollution in the oceans is a huge problem for whales. Just like,
really?
Yeah, big ships moving around and churning up the water, that makes a lot of sound. And
I guess that makes sense, but like that's wild to think about.
Yeah, you don't think of noise pollution when you think of things polluting the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it disorients them and makes it harder for them to hunt, or for the big ones, harder to find mates all across the ocean. But yeah, and speaking of the allusion to culture there, let's talk about their brains.
Let's do it.
So, a quick note, this is not related to the rest of the brain conversation, but I think it's really neat. They're able to put half their brain to sleep at a time so that they don't drown. And somehow that just works for them.
I would love to know what that means, put half their brain to sleep, but...
Yeah, I'm not going to elaborate much farther.
Yeah, I figured as much.
Yeah, some of them do, like, sleep most of their brain at a time, in which case, for example, like sperm whales, they mostly like float vertically in the water.
Mm-hmm.
And will sleep for a bit, but they can't hold their breath forever, you know.
Right.
But especially things like dolphins that you know, there's really not much that'll eat a full-grown sperm whale. So they're not afraid to just be hanging out in the water sleeping for a bit. Things will eat dolphins, so they can't really do that. But yeah, so moving on from sleeping half your brain, I really wish I could do that. cetaceans are famously super smart. When it comes to intelligence, they're basically on par or smarter than most primates. And it's hard to test intelligence in non-human animals to begin with.
I was trying to find a way to ask that. Like, what does that even mean? How can we tell that?
A variety of ways. The classic one is what's called the mirror test, where basically you see if they recognize themselves in a mirror or whether they think it's like another of their species. Mm-hmm. And they do that. They like put like a non-permanent paint or something on the animal and see like how it reacts, if it reacts differently to seeing like itself without the paint. More or less. And so if it can recognize itself, that's like sort of alludes to that it has a concept of self, which is just sort of a higher level cognition sort of thing. And so it's hard to, you know, measure intelligence in animals that can't consent to being measured to begin with.
Right.
It's super hard to test the intelligence of these gigantic whales because A, we don't have mirrors that big. And B, if we did, it probably wouldn't make a good reflection of them anyway, that they, so they wouldn't really be able to see it. So for the big whales, right, it's really hard to tell. Also the fact that we've never had them in captivity before. So most of this that I'm going to talk about comes from dolphins.
We've never tried to have whales in captivity?
Not the big ones, because, for example, the smallest baleen whale is still, like, 25 feet.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, like, a little smaller than an orca. And we've had orcas, but they're also these whales, I don't remember which species it is, but they're also a lot less athletic than orcas are, so they can't really do fun tricks and jump out of the water and stuff.
okay.
So, we've never really tried. Or at least while we were still going out and catching wild cetaceans to bring back, I don't think they ever really tried.
Okay.
But, yeah, so basically all this is from dolphins. But dolphins are geniuses. They have this structure in the brain called spindle neurons. And this, we've dissected, like, humpback whale brains and stuff, so pretty much all cetaceans have this. We used to think these spindle neurons were unique to the great apes. We've never found them in anything else besides great apes and cetaceans. And we found them, like I said, in a variety of cetaceans. And these, as we understand them in us, these are the things that are used to understand emotions, judgment, social cues, and a concept called the theory of mind. I went into a little philosophy for this episode. Basically, the theory of mind is the idea that others might think and feel differently than you do, and that they might have different ideas and intentions than you do. So that just inherently assumes that you have like a concept of self and can understand how you are thinking and feeling.
Mm-hmm.
And that understanding that other people don't think and feel and do things the same way you do.
Sure. Like, you are not the only person that exists.
Right. And that's how we understand how they work in humans. And they're of a comparable proportion of the brain in basically the same, like, area of the brain that we see them in. We see that the same in cetaceans. So it's kind of assumed that they are being used in the same way.
Mm-hmm.
And so this next part is subjective. But based on everything I've read, some cetaceans are effectively people. Which is hard to say.
Like, what does that mean?
Like, if they are aware of themselves and aware of, like, others in a culture.
Mm-hmm.
And can basically steal memes from each other like humpback whales do, stealing each other's songs.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It's kind of hard to say that, like, that's not, like, a conscious being.
Aren't those two different things? Like, this is a conscious being versus this is a person?
Yeah. I mean, that's also another philosophical argument.
That's fair. Yeah, I mean, it definitely sounds like, regardless, they are incredibly high-level, intelligent creatures. Exactly. The terms that you apply to that, I guess, might vary depending on what you're trying to talk about.
Yeah. And maybe people isn't quite the right word to use there, but yeah. Right. So all of that kind of makes this next part a little ethically weird in that, like I said, most of what we know about cetacean intelligence come from having them in captivity.
Which is not recommended anymore.
No. And so because of that, like I said, basically all this comes from toothed whales. Okay, here's where that I have that in my notes. The smallest baleen whale is about 15 to 20 feet long, about the mm-hmm. same size as a female orca. But like I said, they can't do tricks. also, most baleen whales, so that's like one species that's that small. Most of them are like in the 40 plus foot long range, which just doesn't work in captivity, mm-hmm. even when we thought we could keep cetaceans in captivity well. So yeah, no whales really work in captivity, but especially not those. And a quick aside, again, about whales in captivity, since we're about to move on to some different topics here. I believe zoos are important. Big supporter of zoos here myself. I think they're really great as places of education and conservation. I think they do a lot of really important work. However, some animals just don't belong in, like, public-facing zoos.
Mm-hmm.
Namely, just to start with, cetaceans and primates probably don't. however, we're not gonna get into all of that. I think there's potentially space for cetaceans to be kept in, like, research zoos that aren't public-facing for conservation purposes, and some that mm-hmm. probably should be, but aren't. Complex conversation to have here, maybe for a future episode.
Okay.
But yeah, so moving on, generally, as with most extant groups that we talk about, you know, groups that are still alive today, we're going to talk a little bit about their conservation. Generally, whales aren't doing great, but they are better off, a lot better off, than they were just a few decades ago. And that mainly comes down to whaling being a huge part of, like, human history for thousands of years, basically as soon as boats were invented. So it's just sort of ingrained very deeply into certain cultures around the world. And it's not hard to see why whaling would be very culturally important. It's literal tons of food for your village.
Right.
Oils and fats have been used for lots of purposes over the thousands of years. Like starting fires and maintaining fires, waterproofing different materials like boats. During the Industrial Revolution, whale fats and oils were used for machine lubricants. Stuff like that, as recently as that. And much more recently, as I was a little shocked to learn. their bones also are big enough to be used for houses. So it's like, you sure get your mileage out of a whale. But as per usual, things got really bad when capitalism got involved.
Yeah, things got a little out of hand.
Yep. In the late 1800s through the 1960s, you, dear listener, may have been alive then. we sure weren't, but you might have been. Whaling drove most of the baleen whales very close to extinction. Lots of populations and potential, and you know, some subspecies, depending on how you count them, have gone extinct due to overhunting, you know, particularly in like the northern Pacific. But this is generally the case sort of around the world. And it's a little deceptive because if you look at some of like the individual species as a whole, they might be listed as least concern by the IUCN. That's, you know, who publishes, you know, what is endangered, what's critically endangered. Some of them are listed as least concern because, you know, they have global populations. But many of, like, mm-hmm. sort of the smaller populations are listed as critically endangered. And so, since the mid-1940s, there have been some real efforts to conserve whales. while still leaving room for certain indigenous groups to hunt whales that they kind of need to survive. That's especially true in, like, the Arctic regions, where it's like, well, they can't exactly farm up there. So whaling is kind of just how they have to live if they are to continue existing.
Right.
And since then, there's broadly been a ban on commercial whaling, and whales have seen a pretty significant recovery overall. And even that's just since, like, the 80s.
I mean, it's nice to know that, like, you know, when measures are taken, like, we can actually track the progress. Like, yeah, like,
100%.
You can do something good, and, like, yes, good things are happening, not just, oh, we tried to do this good thing, and, you know, everything is still bad.
I will say, there's a bit of a caveat to that, and while, yes, it is a cool example of one of the really precious few times when the many countries across the world said, hey, this is a thing we agree is important. Let's stop doing this so that the future can have whales. Mm-hmm. There are very few examples like that, and we need to hold on to those ones. But this also coincidentally coincides with a massive drop in whale population, so it's no longer commercially viable to whale. That's cool. Number two, also, when synthetic and other oils were becoming much more readily available, so you didn't really need whales anymore. And also things like vegetable oils and stuff. So it's like, yeah, we didn't really need them anymore, and there wasn't enough of them to make money off of further anyway. So, but hey, like I said, we'll take what we can get.
Yeah, right. If you don't look into the details too much, it's a wonderful little story.
Right. And this all, like I said, whales have generally been recovering pretty well since. There are some caveats, and I say whales also including dolphins, generally. Dolphins were never really hunted, like, commercially, just because they're not large enough.
Mm-hmm.
However, the marine whales are recovering pretty well. Some of those river dolphins and stuff that are threatened due to, like, pollution and, like, accidentally being caught in fishing nets, river dolphins are not doing well. And there's also a handful of countries that just kind of outright rejected the international whaling ban. Some of them were just like, nah, I'm gonna keep doing it.
Do we know what countries we're talking about here?
Mostly the Nordic countries, like the Scandinavian countries.
Really?
Yeah. And then also Japan has been wishy-washy about it. And then just in like 2018 or 2019, they were like, yeah, we don't think the International Whaling Commission or whatever is doing a good job. We're just gonna keep doing it.
Huh.
Yeah, so like less than 5 years ago. Yeah, so just some quick highlights of some cool whales that are around today before we get into the paleontology of this, you know, paleontology mm-hmm. podcast. So the vaquita, that one that I mentioned at the beginning, is the smallest whale. It is the only native to a very small part of the northern part of the Gulf of California. If you've looked at like a map mm-hmm. of Mexico, how it has that sort of really long peninsula on its west coast.
Right.
That body of water between that and, like, mainland Mexico is the Gulf of California. So they're native to, like, the very northern part of that. Arguably, this is the most endangered animal in the world.
Oh.
There are probably really? Somewhere around 10 individuals left as of last year.
I mean, at that point, can't we functionally say that they're extinct? Just more or less. Waiting on the... Right. Like they will not recover.
Right.
Given what we know. Okay.
And this is the one where I'm like, we probably could have got some of these into captivity 20, 30 years ago. Because it mm-hmm. was, it's not like this was a super recent thing that we discovered. Mm-hmm. Like I said, they're like 4 or 5 feet long. If there's any cetaceans that we should have and probably could have gotten into captivity reasonably well, this is it.
Mm-hmm.
And they did try once it was kind of realized how bad off they were. But basically all the ones they tried with died almost immediately. I think like during the process, like I don't even think they got to like a holding tank or anything.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'd be surprised if these guys make it another decade, to be honest. So sad. Anyway, moving on. The obvious answer for, like, the coolest whale, narwhals.
Yes. I did a project in third grade on narwhals. And what freaked me out is the book I was reading, it said their blood type was unknown. And I don't know why the fact that we didn't know that freaked me out.
Why? That's so weird that it would even specify that. That's so strange.
I think it was blood type or something to do with blood, and it just said, yeah, blood type unknown. And it was like, why would that be included if they don't know?
Yeah,
little
that's
third
weird.
Grade me was like freaked out.
That's really weird. Huh. If you're unfamiliar with narwhals, they're great. They're basically unicorn whales.
Yep.
Their quote-unquote horn is actually not a horn at all. It is their upper left canine tooth, where the tooth socket just sort of rotated. Instead of coming down, it goes forward. And the tusk mm-hmm. just grows through the skin and out the head. And so they use this for... mostly for communicating. It's already full. It's also full of like nerves and stuff. So they mm-hmm. use it as like a temperature sensing thing and stuff like that. Whales generally have really bad eyesight, so this could help them find like a warmer spot in the water where there might be like an air hole or something like that. It was sort of thought, since it, only the males have them, occasionally a female will have them, but it's generally a lot smaller. So it's probably also used in some kind of, like, sexual selection thing. It seems like it's too brittle to be used for, like, sword fighting. but it has been seen that males will, like, rub their horns together. Whether that's, like, an intimidation thing, or whether that's part of how they talk to each other, we kind of don't know. They've been observed using it sort of to hunt. They'll sort of try and smack fish with it and stun them, and they also don't have any other teeth, so we're not entirely
okay.
sure what is it. It seems like it has a lot of different uses.
It seems like it, yeah.
Also, just look up a narwhal skull. They just look so silly. Oh yeah, also, they can sort of have two tusks. Sometimes, like I said, it's the upper right, or I'm sorry, the upper left canine. Sometimes the right one grows in as well, and can go through the skull. So one, they'll have the main one, and then a much shorter one that just sort of pokes out the front of the skull too. Narwhals are so silly.
Wow. Okay.
Another one that I think does not get enough credit for how weird and interesting they are is an entire family called the beaked whales. They get pretty large. They can be like 15 to 40 feet somewhere, depending on the species. And they're called beaked whales because the males have small tusks. Again, just the males, so it's likely for some kind of display or to like sort of joust with other males. However, they're not like big and long like a narwhal's. They sort of just stick out of the mouth a little bit, almost like a pig's tusks. Sort of. Much more like that than like an elephant tusk or a walrus. These tusks are their only teeth. And in one species, the strap-toothed whale, they actually get in the way of eating because they curve. So they're on the bottom jaw. They curve up over the upper jaw.
Oh, jeez.
And they keep the mouth from opening all the way. It apparently doesn't affect them all that much. They seem to be doing mostly fine. But it does restrict how big of a food item they can eat. So it's weird.
Right.
And then lastly, before we get into the paleontology, the blue whale. Like I mentioned at the top of the episode, blue whales are the largest animal that's ever existed on Earth. Currently, they're doing okay. They're listed as endangered instead of critically endangered. There's somewhere around 15,000 to 20,000 individuals. However, less than 100 years ago, there was over 150,000. So they declined by 90% in the last 100 years. Yep.
I assume that's almost entirely due to human activity.
Oh, entirely, yeah.
Okay.
And, like, yeah, there are some other things, like climate change and pollution aren't good, you know, but...
But also, that's still human activity.
Yeah, for sure. These are generally solitary. They don't form big schools or pods, which is probably good, because you'd need so much krill to feed an entire pod of blue whales. So they eat like krill, like I said, the smallest things in the ocean feed the biggest thing in the ocean, which I always think is just kind of cool. And as I said at the beginning too, just cool to be alive at the same time as this thing.
Right. Right. It's nice to have like cool other species. Like that's part of what's cool about the planet is that there's lots of weird stuff.
Yeah, exactly. All right. So now, almost an hour in, it is time for the paleontology part of our paleontology podcast.
Here we go. Let's do it.
Whales have one of the most interesting and well-understood evolutionary histories of at least mammals. Birds probably give them a run for like the most interesting. Arguably humans, but a little biased. And I lied a little bit before when I said that whales are in the order Cetacea. And I'm putting on my nerd glasses here.
Yep.
Cetacea is actually an infraorder of the order Artiodactyla. Mike?
Infraorder.
Yeah, it's just another, like, it's a sub-level, so, like, below.
Sure.
So, Mike, we've talked about them a whole lot on the podcast. What are Artiodactyls?
Oh, I don't remember. I can only think of, like, pterodactyl when I hear, like, that suffix.
That's so fair.
Yeah, I'm out.
Artiodactyls are the even-toed ungulates.
Even-toed? Oh, I remember this.
So these
aren't the squirrely-squirreled shit squid boys. This is something else.
No, these are mammals, number one.
Yeah.
Well, I guess they're vertebrates, right. Number one. So these are things with hooves that have an even number of toes. So things like,
okay,
for example, horses, rhinos, and tapirs have an odd number of toes. Horses just
is it
have
even
the one.
Number like is it even number per like hoof,
yep,
or like in total
per foot?
Okay.
So example, cows have the two big hooves and then like the two smaller, you know, pointier ones that don't always hit the ground. Hippos mm-hmm. have four toes that look mostly like normal toes. So this is basically anything with hooves that's not a horse, a tapir, or a rhino.
Mm-hmm.
You know, cows, sheep, camels, giraffes, pigs, most things. And so they are in this group. So you might be wondering, how? They look so different. And for a long time, we didn't really know how or where they came from. Some thought maybe they came from somewhere in Carnivora. That's the mammal order with bears and dogs and cats and stuff. Since all whales are carnivorous, that is a blanket. They all either eat fish or penguins or seals or squids and stuff, or krill. And for a while, they thought it maybe was somewhere in there. For a while, some people thought that they came from a group called the Mesonychids, which are sort of a carnivorous group of ungulates, so other things with hooves, from the Paleogene period. So this is right after the dinosaurs went extinct. One of the weird sort of hooved groups that were around at this time that didn't make it until today. However, these days, we know that they fall very firmly within those even-toed ungulates, with hippos being their closest relatives. Which vaguely makes a little sense. Hippos are semi-aquatic.
Huge.
They're big. That's true, too. Although they weren't back then. And we'll talk about that.
What? Okay. All right. Sure. Tiny
yeah.
Hippos. Whatever.
Hippos have a weird fossil record. We can talk about that in a later episode. But basically, around 50 million years ago in the Eocene epoch, more on that, mm-hmm. see last episode, 151. And so around this time, ancestors of whales kind of looked like small wolves, but with a bit more of a hunched back and teeny tiny mm-hmm. little hooves at the end of each of their toes instead of claws.
That's fun.
Yeah. The earliest member that we know of that is for sure on like the whale branch is a mm-hmm. genus called Pachycetus. You'll hear this a lot, like seat or cetus comes from, I believe, Greek, means whale.
Mm-hmm.
And also it's from Pakistan, Pachycetus. Sometimes scientific names really are that straightforward.
Yep.
And like I said, it's likely that the first whales that took to the oceans came from around this part of the world, Southeast Asia sort of region. And Pachycetus is really like a textbook transition fossil. So we know for sure that Pachycetus was an artiodactyl based on some morphology of its ankle bones and its hips that have features unique to artiodactyls. So we can for sure say it's one of those. But how do we know that it's an ancient whale when it looks kind of like a wolf? Basically, it had a handful of features. So some of them, like its eyes were at the top of its head, which kind of suggests that it spends time in water. Its eyes were also positioned kind of forwards. Its eyes were kind of in the same spot of like a crocodile's eyes, if you think about it. So it could see it out of the water while still being submerged. Its bones were unusually really dense compared to some of the other ungulates around at the time, to keep it from floating too much. But most importantly, whales have really strange ear, like inner ear bone morphology. And this thing had that similar kind of ear structure that nothing else has. So that's sort of the main thing, where it's like these couple of features that suggest that it liked hanging out in the water, also the ear thing, but also very clearly an artiodactyl based on the ankles and stuff. So no other animal really could possibly have this combination of features, and so this really neatly ties whales to the rest of artiodactyls really nicely. Very shortly after that, so still in the Eocene, another ancient whale shows up, also in this sort of region in Pakistan, called Ambulocetus, which means walking
whale.
That's
a fun name.
Yeah. These guys still look vaguely wolf-like, but if you mix like a wolf with a crocodile. And they're even crocodile-sized. They were about 10 feet long. And these guys have been found pretty much exclusively in nearshore marine environments and estuaries. And you can tell that based on the rocks around it, and you can interpret a lot of what the environment was like by looking at the rocks. Also different isotopes that you can measure by what kind of water it drank. That goes into its bones, and you can tell how much time it spent in fresh water versus marine water. There's different chemical ways you can determine that. And so this guy spent time very much in and around estuaries and sort of nearshore sort of environments. Honestly, living very much like a crocodile does, just hanging out in the water, trying to catch stuff near the shore, sometimes eating fish as well. Their jaws started to develop that cavity that would later end up being filled with jelly to help them hear underneath the water. And they had much sturdier limbs than Pachycetus. Pachycetus still had very much like kind of deer or very thin legs, like a wolf or dog kind of does. But Ambulocetus had much sturdier limbs that they weren't quite as flexible. So the back limbs could only move like sort of back and forth without the kind of rotation side to side that you think of, like how you can move your legs all around. They couldn't really do that. It was only forward and backward for the most part. So they were probably using those to swim instead of a tail at this point. They show no sign of a tail fluke yet, so no tail fin. So they probably swam, like I said, using those hind legs, kind of similar to well, we don't really have anything that would swim like that today, I guess.
It exists as a singular thing on its own.
Yeah, because like the tail, I'm sure, helped, but not quite as much as like an otter, where they have a very long flat tail, or like a beaver or something. Next up, going down the chain, so these two, Pachycetus and Ambulocetus, they were sort of relatively isolated in their groups. I think there's a couple species of both, but they're within the same genus. Next down the line is a pretty diverse family called the Remingtonacetids. I'm sure named after somebody who I don't know. But these are also from the Middle Eocene, so still not that far from when we first see Pachycetus, or when, they split off from the hippos. And still in the same area, Southeast Asia. So, again, the rocks and the isotope analysis indicate these guys are still at this point, or now at this point, mostly in marine environments. So moving out of the rivers, out of the estuaries, mostly marine. But they still had pretty functional legs. Their eyes, weirdly, had sort of shifted back down the skull. Yeah. Cetacean, I mean, they don't really use their eyes that much today, so it's kind of not surprising that they were sort of figuring themselves out along the way. And they were comparatively small, so that just sort of indicates they didn't use them all that much in hunting or getting food, at least. But very importantly, the semicircular canal in the ear was greatly reduced. This is the organ that tells you which way is up when you're on land.
That seems like an important one if you need to, like, you know, breathe in the air.
Or just not fall over.
That too.
But this organ doesn't work as well in water. It still works, as you've probably noticed if you've been underwater. You sort of feel which way is up, mostly because that's the way your body wants to float. Right. But this organ, just the way it is structured, just doesn't work as well in water. So because this is reduced, that kind of shows that they were spending less time in water. More time in water. Like I said, their legs were still there, but much, much shorter than in Ambulocetus or Pachycetus. Tail was much longer. At this point, probably swimming like an otter, using the tail to sort of paddle, as well as the legs. Next, we have something that you could start to see looking sort of like a whale, and that's the family Proto-Cetidae, or the proto-whales. Again, sometimes it is just that easy for scientific names. and at this point, this family is found all across the world. From Africa to North America, other parts of Asia besides sort of the Pakistan-India region. And depending on what species you're looking at, it may or may not have been able to leave the water at all. And they've sort of transitioned from looking like a weird wolf thing to a crocodile thing to, at this point, kind of like a really long but also thick dog. Like, imagine, like, the proportions of, like, a wiener dog, but as, like, barrel-chested as, like, a St. Bernard.
Okay.
Yeah. Again, weird.
Yes.
There is a specimen of the genus Myocetus, which means mother whale, that was fossilized while pregnant. That's where it gets the name. And the baby was pointing head first, which is important because that's how all the rest of the mammals give birth, is head first. Whales, however, give birth tail first. Otherwise, the baby would drown during birth.
Whales give birth tail first. Yep. Why would the baby drown?
Because sometimes childbirth takes a while. And if the head is poking out first...
can't go up and get air. Yep.
Stuck for a while.
Understood.
But because Myocetus was preserved with this baby pointing out head first, that sort of suggests that at least Myocetus could go up and give birth on land. Whether or not some of the others did, it's kind of impossible to say. But probably likely that they could at least, you know, like a seal. You know how seals like aren't good on land, but they can sort of bounce around?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe something like that, or maybe more like a sea lion, because like I said, they do still have legs that are mostly functional. The eyes are basically in the same place as modern whales, but the nostrils, the blowhole, was not there yet. It was still only about halfway up the head. So imagine, as our dog referenced earlier, now their nose is between their eyes. Imagine that.
Okay, so we've started to go back down now. Okay.
No, they're starting to go up.
Wait, I thought they were up on top.
Not yet. This is it getting there.
Oh, okay. Sure.
Yep. In Pachycetus and Ambulocetus, the nose was at the end of the snout where it belongs. But now in these Proto-Cetids, it had started to move up, but wasn't quite there yet to where it is, you know, in modern whales.
Mm-hmm.
Most of them had inner ear structures that honestly look pretty bad for hearing both on land and in water. So at this point in their, you know, evolution, they probably didn't rely on hearing, you know, directly all that much, but that jelly-filled jaw sac was getting bigger and bigger, so they probably were using that kind of induction hearing, which isn't all that uncommon. For example, like snakes don't have external ears at all. They hear exclusively through their jaw, pretty much. So some species at this point also had a pelvis. As I mentioned before, in modern whales, the pelvis is just kind of free-floating in the body. At this point, it wasn't really fused to the spine anymore. Or if it was, it was only by like one vertebra instead of by the typical like five vertebra that sort of fuse to form the hips in most mammals. And again, limbs, small but still clumsily able to walk on land, probably. Next, onto something you'd actually see and call a whale instead of some kind of weird ocean dog thing. By the late Eocene, so this is less than 10 million years like away from Pachycetus, we see animals like Basilosaurus, which sounds like it should be a reptile, but it's actually a whale. Scientific naming sometimes is that hard. when they first found it, they thought it was like a mosasaur or something, or some other marine reptile, and because of the way naming works, that's the one it was called first, so that has to stick. Sure.
Mm-hmm.
Even though it doesn't make sense. But yeah, so Basilosaurus and its relatives were the first fully obligate aquatic cetaceans. They could not go on land without dying pretty quickly. They still had visible hind limbs, but they were teeny tiny. And were probably only used for reproduction, to sort of positioning each other in a way that, you know, lines up. At this point, the blowhole was nearly in its modern place. No more weird freak nose between your eyes sort of thing. And I hate myself for this, but for all intents and porpoises.
Wow.
This was a full whale.
This is what happens when Fee is not around. All right.
Yeah.
Actually, no, I take it back. Fee would have loved that.
Yes, she would have.
I'm giving Fee too much credit here. And to be honest, so do I. What am I even saying here? Well done.
Thank you.
Great work.
Thank you. I had that one in the chamber, and I was waiting for a place to slot it in. but yeah, for all intents and purposes, this was a full whale at this point. They lacked the melon on the top of their head, and they still had teeth. So this is sort of before the split between the toothed whales and the baleen whales. This is sort of like their common ancestor sort of thing. So if you took the common denominator between the two, that's mostly what these guys look like. They had flippers for the most part. They still had like an elbow joint in it, although for the most part it was still a flipper. Just a little more flexible than modern whales. They had the full tail fluke, and for the most part they were real long. If not as massive size, like girth wise, as some of the large whales are today. For example, the most famous one, Basilosaurus cetoides, could get up to about 60 feet. And so, like I said, this is like less than 10 million years away from the little medium dog sized Pachycetus. We now have the 60 foot long Basilosaurus.
Just with an incredible name, too.
Oh, yeah. It's great. I think it actually means like king lizard.
Really?
Ironic. Their hearing by this point was fully adapted for underwater life, and this entire family that includes Basilosaurus filled basically all of the niches that at least toothed whales do today. There were smaller genera like Durodon, which is also a really well-known famous one. It was about dolphin-sized. And it was much more lightly built. It was about 15 feet long, and it's probably from within the sort of Durodon side of this Basilosaurus family that the rest of the modern whales come from. And so at this point, we got our full whales, but we basically just need to take this sort of amalgamation of the two groups and then split it into the two groups that we have today. And basically all that means is for the baleen whales, we got to get baleen. that's kind of it. For the tooth whales, echolocation. That's the main thing missing. And so those two groups that we have today, baleen whales, tooth whales, they split sometime in the early Oligocene epoch, sometime around 34 million years ago or so. And starting with the baleen whales, fundamentally, baleen is just like giant hair. That's kind of all it is. And it's hair that is just organized and grown in a very specific way. And so whales are mammals. So fundamentally, the building blocks for originating baleen as a structure is kind of easy to see. We're pretty sure, at least everything I've seen seems to indicate that like Basilosaurus probably didn't have hair, even though like Ambulocetus, Pachycetus, those all had hair like a normal mammal. Basilosaurus probably didn't, and whales today do not have any hair, with the exception of baleen, loosely. So it's they have the genetics to grow hair because they're mammals, so it's easy to see how that could accidentally happen from a mutation or something. However, hair doesn't fossilize well. Actual fossils of baleen are really hard to find. It's likely that there was some kind of slow transfer from teeth, like a normal whale, to teeth and baleen, sort of working together to just baleen. And we can see that in the handful of fossils we do have, there are, on the jaw, nerves and blood vessels in some of these species that lead to something that is not the teeth. But whatever that structure is not there. It's assumed that it was attached to baleen of some kind, but it's really hard to say. So, unfortunately, less satisfying answer than we'll get for the toothed whales. but this does,
and that is, yeah, that's part ahead. Of the fun of this podcast is when we get less satisfying answers.
Yeah. This does really nicely coincide time-wise with when it would have made sense for baleen whales to diversify, because it's around the time when Antarctica had fully split from the other continents and was creating and shaking up all these ocean currents that were generally much more productive than they had been previously, meaning that there's more stuff in the water, like krill. So this new food source was ready to be exploited by these baleen whales, and they took off and grew to the massive sizes that we have today.
Right.
On the other side, we got the toothed whales that more or less just needed to get the melon. That's kind of the only piece missing from Durodon.
Needed to get the melon.
Yep. Walked right into that one. The melon structure, because if you look at a whale skull, a toothed whale skull at least, it's very obvious that there is something, that there is definitely space for something on the front of the skull. And so this sort of shape that you're like, okay, there's obviously something here that is just not fossilized, started to show up in the middle Oligocene. So this is, around 30 million years ago or so. And with a genus called Squalodon. It doesn't seem like Squalodon. I didn't see any specific reasons given why, but just based on its morphology, it doesn't seem like this is like the common ancestor of the rest of the toothed whales. It just seems like this is like the first one where it's like, oh, that probably had an early type of melon. So this just kind of seems like the trend that the ancestors of several groups of toothed whales were doing at this time. Of all of the modern families and stuff of toothed whales that we have today, pretty much all of them show up in the late Oligocene or early Miocene, about 25 million years ago or so. And I'm just going to go over some standouts that are fun from, you know, the early days of whales through some of the kind of recent ones. My two favorites. There's a genus called Leviathan, named after the biblical giant monster, the Leviathan. It was a type of...
Okay.
Yeah. It was named as a type of sperm whale. So imagine a sperm whale with that big boxy head is also about the same size as a sperm whale, so 50-ish feet. However, as I mentioned way earlier at the beginning, sperm whales are mostly deep diving hunters that eat stuff like squid. They only mm-hmm. have teeth on the bottom jaw because squid are pretty squishy. You don't need a whole bunch of teeth. However, Leviathan had giant teeth at the top and the bottom and most likely ate other whales. It also lived at the same time and in the same places as a little known shark you might have heard of called Otodus megalodon.
As it turns out, I have heard of that one.
Yeah, and so it probably competed for food with megalodon, and the two almost certainly ate each other.
Okay.
Yeah, so megalodon was not the only giant thing running around, swimming around in the oceans, eating whales at this time. There was also a whale doing it. However, this is what we're going to end on here. My favorite whale, and right up there with my favorite genus names, Odobenacetops.
Odobenacetops.
Yes.
Like, I don't know, that just feels good coming out of your mouth. Right? Odobenacetops.
It sure does. And I love it because the name means walrus-faced whale. Which is, it fits.
Okay.
Ecologically, when it was around, I don't believe walruses were around. I don't know for sure that's true. I didn't look that up. But ecologically, they do similar things to what walruses do. They basically use, like, suction to, you know, suck up hard shell things off the ocean floor, things like clams and crabs. Mm-hmm. And then they just sort of crush them up in their mouth, without using teeth. They have the same kind of, like, flat, round muzzle that walruses do, and they also had tusks, like a walrus. However, unlike a walrus, these tusks were asymmetrical. So walruses have the two that are pretty much the same. The right tusk of Odobenacetops was about 3 to 4 feet long, and the left one was much shorter, only a couple of inches. And this is mostly in males. I think.
Why?
I don't know. Yeah.
That had to be such a weird thing to look at.
You know what's even worse?
Oh?
They pointed backwards.
What do you mean they pointed backwards?
They pointed down the side of the whale. Instead of a narwhal that points to the front, these pointed to the back.
That seems like it'd be dangerous. Like you could stab yourself.
You'd think so, but whales can't really move their neck much.
Okay.
At least side to side, they can't really. And they swim up and down. So they you wouldn't run into it just, you know, swimming, really. Yeah. And so these, like I said, the tusks were 3 to 4 feet long. The animal itself was only 10 to 12 feet long. So this was like a third of its length. Just this big old tusk coming down one side of the body. And you might be thinking, hey, there's another whale that we talked about with a weird asymmetrical tusk. Do these weirdos happen to be related to narwhals? And why, yes, they are. However,
there's a but. Okay.
You'll be surprised to hear that not only is the tusk not the same tooth between the two, it's on the other side of the head.
All right, man.
So narwhals...
I can't keep any of this straight.
Yeah. Narwhals have the tusk... Their tusk is from the left maxilla, so like the bone on the top of the jaw that most of your teeth are on. Mm-hmm. So it's on the left side. And Odobenacetops has it come from the right premaxilla. Other side from the front.
Yep. Sure.
Yep. So they're related. Tusks are totally independent. And that's where they're my favorite. They're just so weird. There's so many left turns that I love them. And they have a fun name.
Of course they do. Say it one more time.
Odobenacetops.
Odobenacetops. That's one of my favorite parts about the show, to be honest. It's just the names that get dropped on a, you know, a bi-weekly basis.
Yeah. And yeah, so that's whales.
Is that whales?
That's whales.
That's whales, everybody. We were talking about this before we started. Like, it's a real shame that that Fia wasn't here for the Whales episode. Just, you know, this is Fia's wheelhouse, stuff in the water.
Yeah, I'm hoping she'll be here, because at least next week, if the ants, you know, does pan out, at least it's invertebrates, which I know hold a hold a place in her heart. So it's not marine invertebrates. Just like, you know, this episode was marine things. Next episode's invertebrates. Maybe at we're some point there. we'll get there.
At some point we'll converge. But until then, this has been episode 132 of I Wish You Were Dead, a podcast about things that used to be alive. My name is Mike, and that was Gavin. We hope to have Fia here in a couple weeks, and we'll see all of you then. Take care, everybody.
This episode of I Wish You Were Dead was written by Gavin Davidson and hosted by Gavin Davidson, Mike Bryson, and Finella Campanino. It was sound edited and edited for YouTube by Gavin Davidson. Special thanks to former guests of the pod and to listeners like you.